The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So my name is Ramesh Saira. I've given a few talks here, including one about a month ago. Just for those of you who don't know who I am, I'm a psychiatrist by profession. I've been coming to Common Ground for about 12 years. I do random workshops here and there, and currently I'm also serving on the board. And then this is a disclaimer I mentioned before every talk. I have no pretensions to being a teacher, regardless of what the board there says. I'm just an ordinary practitioner, and I use these opportunities to as a support group. So I practice, and then I find some wisdom, or I find some flaws, and I share it with others so that you don't have to invent those wheels. So the talk I gave a month ago was titled something like Keeping It Simple, because we have a tendency to complicate things, all aspects of our life, including meditation practice. Today, as you may have suspected, based on the guided meditation, I'm going to talk about concentration practice, or samadhi. For me, it followed as a kind of a logical next step, because from the beginning, I always got confused about... Is this too loud? Okay. I got confused about what am I doing? Should I be practicing concentration, or should I probably be practicing vipassana? Because if my mind is not calm enough, I can't be watching what's going on. But on an average day, my mind's bouncing around all over the place, that unless I am calm, I can't watch. If I start watching what's going on, my mind is going all over the place. So I used to have many sits where I would start off with, I'm going to be watching what's going on, and then 7-8 minutes later, just feel so scattered that I decide, okay, let me do some concentration practice. But then as I'm trying to concentrate, the energy is bubbling up because my mind is wanting to go all over the place, that I find I can't concentrate. So then I go back to, oh, let me see what's going on. So this kind of a repetitive thing. And so, you study, you practice, and then I have some sense of what the role of each of these two components is. So first of all, just a quick survey. How many of you have some familiarity with samadhi or concentration practice versus vipassana or insight practice? Some. How many of you, are these new terms, new terminologies? Okay, and so even those of you who have some familiarity, I would really encourage you to question, because you can get stuck in a rut, and the worst thing that can happen is you either expend too much energy and then get frustrated, or you can reach a state of numbness where you get comfortable with one level of practice, and then it just becomes a habit as opposed to a true inquiry into the workings of the mind. So you hear, as you read the literature, even, not the Pali canon, but even just books, regular books and articles, you'll hear various terms like vipassana or sati or samadhi, and then also the English versions of like open awareness, concentration, one-pointed awareness, and then it can often get a little confusing. So today I'll focus just on the samadhi or the concentration part. The vipassana is the main goal of the practice we do here, but you need some foundations. And as you know, if you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, you have the sila, samadhi, and punya. There are these three components of living a wholesome life, having some concentration, which then gives rise to wisdom. And so one aspect that we often don't pay attention to is the kind of living a wholesome life. If we lead lives of constant distraction, constant craving and giving in to senses, it's going to be really difficult to achieve the other two. So we won't be talking today about the kind of wholesome life or virtuous life, but make sure that you pay attention to that as well. But today we'll be talking about the role of concentration. So since I mentioned some of the other words, just to kind of give a brief definition, and then we'll set them aside. So vipassana is what we hear often in this area of Buddhist practice, and it's translated as insight, but it's the kind of probably the kind of pure translation would be to see through. So we live in a kind of a cloud of delusion. We don't perceive the reality the way it is, and then we have a distorted perception, and we have a way of habitually reacting to. So the idea of vipassana practice is to create a kind of a cultivate a practice so that we can see the processes of the mind working and our relationship to our life just the way things are. But what comes in the way is our minds are bouncing around constantly, reacting. So then getting stuck in that vicious circle of, I want to study my mind, but it's so restless that I can't study my mind. And so we need some preparatory work. The other word you may come across is sati, or mindfulness. And it's more, it's the kind of core of the activity that you do. It is to, the kind of the Sanskrit word is smriti, which means to remember. And sati is often translated as to recollect. And the only recollection here is that you have decided that you will bring your awareness to the present moment. And given that we live so much of our daily lives in distraction, that you need to remind yourself over and over again. And that's the basic act of mindfulness. It is to be mindful of bringing your awareness to the present moment. And then we come to concentration, which is a more narrowly focused actual technique that helps us in the process. So we have a certain level of concentration and calmness, then it's easy for your mind to stay mindful, to come back, keep coming back to the present moment. And when you do that sufficiently long enough, then you have some chance of seeing the reality of the way things are, and that's vipassana. And roughly speaking, so that's the kind of sequence or some logic to why we do some of these practices. And the kind of counterpart that I often talk about in my professional work, clinical work, is in psychology we talk about, again, awareness, attention, and concentration. And so you can be awake but not aware. Often when we are on long drives, you know, you can drive almost mindlessly for 30, 40 minutes and then not even be aware. So just because you're awake doesn't mean you're aware. And it happens, my wife is talking, it happens like 3/4 of the time. It's like, I am aware, but not aware, not listening. So awareness is this state of, this ability of our cognition to connect to something here and now. Attention is the act of bringing that awareness to something. I am looking at that cup. I'm looking at this gentleman. So that is attention. But can I keep that attention long enough, and that is concentration. So sustained attention is concentration. So there are some parallels in just plain psychology and Buddhist psychology. And many teachers will say, and I'm inclined to go along with that, they're very uncomfortable with this translation of samadhi as concentration. So there are many other words that are often used. One is called one-pointedness, or a gathering of the awareness, or a centering, or unification of mind. Pick any of these things, but many of them actually, in this instance, prefer to use the word samadhi because it does not have any of these English correlations that often have a sense of effort. When you tell somebody concentrate, there is a forcefulness to it. There is, you know, our instinct is to push away from something and let me concentrate, which is not the natural habit. And so anything that's done in an effortful way in this practice actually often causes more problems. So like many teachers, I'm inclined to, in this instance, to use the Pali word samadhi, although the Sanskrit word is the same thing as well. Unfortunately, if those of you who have an eclectic taste in spiritual pursuits, if you read other aspects of, you know, Hindu metaphysics, you will come across the word samadhi quite often, and often meaning very differently. In fact, if you read Patanjali's sutras about Raja Yoga, the very final state is samadhi. It's almost equivalent of enlightenment. And so it can be confusing. So with that caveat, I would say everything that I'm going to talk about samadhi pertains to this insight meditation practice. So the other thing about samadhi is to recognize that it's just a practice. It's like training your mind the same way that you would train your mind to train your mind and body to learn a new musical instrument. or even a physical act like, you know, riding a bicycle or riding a car. It requires patient persistence, but more you do it, the more it becomes wired into the process, and then you don't have to pay as much attention, which then frees your awareness to do the work of insight meditation practice. But initially, it will feel effortful, but it should not be forced effort. The other thing which many teachers, many of them I respect greatly, have acknowledged that some of them have been in, like Gil Fronsdal in California. He was in Zen for many years before he, you know, transitioned to Vipassana. And he said even with all those Zen retreats where they can have a single sit for 2 to 3 hours, his mind never got into the states of deep concentration that many teachers and many, you know, books talk about. And from a neurophysiology, neuropsychology point of view, I do believe that there are different differences in our innate ability to settle into the deep states of concentration. But it doesn't matter. The whole idea is to train your mind within its abilities to the level of concentration it can achieve, because the goal is not to be immersed into a state of deep concentration, but it's just to create enough settledness, enough calmness, so that you can then use the awareness to study the workings of the mind, which is Vipassana. So as I mentioned earlier, especially I mentioned a few times during the guided meditation, is that efforting is a bad thing when you're doing concentration. So it's a relaxed state of persistence and repetition. So if you go back to the kind of, if you break down the word samadhi, apparently it means the different components mean together and then towards and then pulling. So the whole idea is that you pull a couple of things together. But together doesn't mean enmeshed, it just means being with something. So if I want my awareness to be with the pressure sensation of my body seated on this cushion, I don't really need to bore my attention deep into this pressure sensation. I just have to have a sense of, this is what the pressure feels like, and my awareness can come here and be with it. If it wanders away, I just have to come back. Whereas when you say I need to concentrate, there is a sense of I must do it, I have to do it, let me grasp it. There is a way of kind of making an effort, a muscular effort, that comes in the way of doing it. And then it's followed by negative thoughts about I'm not doing it right, and etc. There are many benefits of samadhi practice, even setting aside the benefits to as a preliminary step to Vipassana practice. So many of you lead very busy lives. Some of you may be parents, you may have busy jobs, you may be working multiple jobs, and it's sometimes the goals of Vipassana practice just seem so far away. And you try and you try, but then it just seems like you're getting nowhere. And then often the tendency is to drop it and then do what you're used to doing, which is doing something that brings you comfort, whether it's TV, internet, you know, gossiping, etc. But samadhi practice, even if you do it as a separate, isolated concentration practice, has its benefits. And so one is that by its very nature, because you're just asking the mind to do one thing, come back and attach to this particular thing over and over again, your mind does not have the ability to constantly bounce around over 10, 15 thought processes, which is very energy consuming. So you do it for a while, and then there is a natural sense of calm that comes in. And so that's one of the key things to remember, is you don't do samadhi practice to be calm. You do samadhi practice and calmness will settle down if the other conditions are right. So if tomorrow morning you have a very busy and stressful meeting or a schedule, expecting your mind to be calm this evening may be asking for too much. But you still go through the process, and your mind may not be racing at 80 miles an hour. It may come down to 60 miles an hour. But if you've had a good day and you're still on your summer vacation and tomorrow is going to be just a day off, then your mind can really calm down to a state of 10, 20 miles an hour. So that's one key thing to remember, is it's not a goal-directed activity, as in you're not expecting a certain outcome, but often calmness and tranquility is a natural outcome of the mind not bouncing around. So this is a benefit to anyone, regardless of whether they've been connected to a meditation center. It's a practice that every teenage should be doing. Kids with so-called ADD should be doing it. And those of us who just tend to worry a lot, it's not a bad thing for us to do it on a regular basis, just like exercising. This is one of those practices that's done very often in sportsmen. And so the other thing that we do in the process of samadhi practice is we are channeling the energies. So we have the mind's energy to constantly seek for some sense of zing, something to energize it. And we don't realize how much energy that's wasted doing brain activity. So as you just ask the mind to do just the one thing, and as the energy level goes down, you also have the ability now to channel your energies even without being aware of it. And the example would be, these are interviews that I heard. So Tiger Woods, way back before he got into trouble, and there was one, one of the major championships that he won on the last hole. And then, that evening during an interview, the interviewer said, we who were in the booth, the commentary booth, could not sit down because we were so tensed up wanting you to make the putt. But you just kind of walked back and forth as if it was just something casual. And he said, yeah, for me, it was just a putt on a Sunday afternoon because everything else was just a story. The fact that if I don't make the putt, I won't win this championship, and I'll be so disappointed, I won't win the millions. All those things are not necessary for that final putt. And same thing, Phil Jackson, and those of you who are of a certain vintage, when he used to coach the Chicago Bulls, he tamed Dennis Rodman. I mean, so just think of the final game that Michael Jordan won. It was at the buzzer. It was everyone knew what was going to happen. The ball's in the sidelines, Scottie Pippen throws the ball to Michael Jordan, and then all he has to do, 2 seconds left, is to aim and shoot. The rest of the story does not matter. But I remember watching that game because I so wanted, the Bulls to win. And it was, I couldn't sit still, but if you think of what was necessary for that act, nothing other than hear the buzzer, receive the ball, aim and shoot. Which I can do in my practice court, but at that time I would probably have not even received the ball. And so you can really train your concentration, you can use the samadhi practice to hone your skills in some parts of your life. But as you know, samadhi practice does not make you a wise person because of what happened to Tiger Woods subsequently with the golf clubs going through the back of his car. And so that's the other key thing, is there is not much wisdom if samadhi practice is all about just bringing your attention back to the present moment. But again, going on to other benefits, there is a momentum that builds up due to our modern day lives. We have a linear way of thinking. There is a problem that arises, we analyze it, we come up with a few causes, and then we come up with a solution. There is a linearity to how we think, and that thought process helps us. Unfortunately, in many other aspects of life, that linearity of thinking is actually counterproductive. In our interpersonal relationships, whether it's at work or romantic, dealing with kids, dealing with traffic, geopolitical stuff, there's a lot of grayness. But our habitual tendencies is to just, our mind believes that if I just think about this problem enough, I'll solve it. And a lot of energy is wasted in the process. So regular practice of, concentration practice or samadhi practice will kind of slowly slow down this natural tendency. You can't tell your mind to slow down the thinking, but if you give it something to do, you slow down the momentum. So again, even if you're not committed Vipassana practitioner, doing this on a regular basis has, this ancillary benefits. And the more important thing that I mentioned earlier, and this has really helped me personally, is patience. There is something intrinsic about this process. If you're not patient about samadhi practice, you'll never get anywhere. The process itself involves you sticking with it. And so some of you may be impatient, and you may tell yourself, I need to learn to be patient. And you can say that for year after year and get nowhere. So this is a way of giving your mind something wholesome to do, and along the way you'll find that you're less reactive, less impulsive, and just a little more patient. So there are three types of concentration practice, and some of this I alluded to earlier. So there is this wholesomeness of the practice that, you know, we're engaging in, meaning we want to do it on a regular basis so that we have some stillness of the mind, so that it becomes easier for us to practice mindfulness and eventually have some sense of wisdom and vipassana. That's wholesome concentration. The other one is the more neutral, where it's less about a spiritual practice but more a practical consideration. So I mentioned about sports, but some of you will become better at your work. You know, we get so many distractions in the day. If you train yourself and then set some guidance, so you will check your email only every 30 minutes, or you won't check your Facebook once but every 3 to 4 hours. If you don't have the sense of bouncing around constantly, you will find that regularity of concentration practice does help even that kind of practical situation. The unwholesome kind of concentration, again, there is unwholesome. A burglar is an extremely concentrated person. A burglar who is in your house in the middle of the night his awareness is entirely on his field right now, but it's completely unwholesome. We don't call it wise concentration. So concentration by itself is just a generic tool that can be put to all kinds of uses. So let's talk about the practical aspects of samadhi practice. So one healthy way to approach this is to look upon it as an exercise, as something you do that's a training exercise. Some of you may be familiar with neuroplasticity, so nerves that fire together, wire together. So whether it's habit or habits of doing things or habits of thinking, there are patterns that develop. So if a certain person irritates you and you react to that, every time you react in the same way, that circuitry is being reinforced. And then every time you do it, and then you react with frustration, I shouldn't be like this, but then don't do anything about it, another wiring is set up. So this person annoys you, you react with irritation, and then you react to that with frustration. And 5 years of doing that, you just really strengthened it. And how much ever you think to yourself, I shouldn't do it, it doesn't happen because we're doing it mindlessly. We're doing it without an awareness of the cause and effect, and so we keep reacting and it gets very frustrating. So those of you who like a kind of scientific basis for what we're doing here, and this is essentially rewiring. So a mind's tendency for when you ask it to do something boring is to wander off into something else. So this is a way of training your mind to keep coming back to the present moment over and over again as a way of neuroplasticity, as a way of rewiring. But it also strengthens your natural tendency to be patient, to pause. So what I found is that as I've done this practice for years, that I have a problem with driving. Some of you who heard my talks before know that I have a problem with driving. Not driving per se, but the people I encounter. But I still react to them, but there is a slowing down of the process now. After these last few years, there is just a notion that things seem to be happening in slow motion. That jackass that breezed past me in that big black truck, who could be a Jenny ass too, but I don't know. You know, is that it happening in slow motion? I can feel the tightness, but then it just goes down a lot more quickly. But even 4 years ago, there was this kind of reactivity. But prior to this, the more I thought about I shouldn't react, it just became another kind of sequence in a black truck, me angry, I shouldn't react. Black truck, me angry, I shouldn't react, over and over again. So what I found is by training my mind in patience in a completely different way, it slowed down my reactive process in other areas of life as well. So look upon it as a skill that you're cultivating. And then just the same way that you would train your child or the proverbial puppy that you come across in many teachings, just be gentle with it. And the repetitiveness is so important. That's why I'll keep repeating it. It's so easy to get jaded by hearing the same words until you realize how bad we are at persisting at things that we don't like to do. It's so much easier just to flip on the TV or do something that just releases us from this tension of boredom or restlessness. And then the other thing to remember is that as you sit down, and you can set aside, you know, 5 minutes, 2-3 times a day is better than 30 minutes once a day. Set realistic goals. And so the other thing is this intention that I talked about in my last talk, there's this concept of primary intention and secondary intention. So one is, right now some of you may accept my premise that it's good for you to do concentration practice. Once you do it for a few times, it gets boring. And then why do it? It's like me telling myself no to that chocolate ice cream or cookie over and over again. Why am I doing this? Why am I suffering? For that, I need this kind of broader sense of the bigger secondary intention. There is a wholesome desire for why I'm doing it. So I say no to this cookie right now because I don't want this appalling feeling of being beholden to this lump of brown stuff. You know, how can this stuff have so much control over my well-being? And same way here is that, how can I be so impatient? At the age of 51, 10 years ago when I started coming here, I thought I should be in a state of semi-nirvana by now. But I'm not there yet. But somewhere along the way, I realized that I had set myself artificial goals. So that's where this kind of wholesome sense of somewhere down the line, I will not react as kind of mindlessly as I've been doing. And I've seen many instances in my life, either I've observed it myself or people close to me have observed that in certain instances, I don't seem to get as wound up or as tightened or as reactive as in the past. So you need to have both, because what keeps you going in the present moment is this wholesome intention that somewhere down the line, you don't want to be beholden to your mind is constantly reacting and causing you suffering. And the other, it's a given that you will have good and bad days. Just like I mentioned earlier, Sunday evening meditations are more restless than Friday evening meditations, unless you had a couple of libations, some appropriate drinks on a Friday evening. But in general, when the next day, when the foreseeable future brings you some joy and relaxation, it's easy to get into a more concentrated state. So the goal of this practice is not to get to a certain state of calmness or stillness. It's about doing the best you can under these circumstances. The great thing about actually doing it on a Sunday evening when your mind is restless about Monday is that's the training. That training is, in fact, more effective for your daily life. It's like Michael Jordan training over and over again for that practice shot. And I know many of these athletes, actually, their coaches will create that atmosphere. They won't have the all the crowds, but they'll have huge loudspeakers creating that scene and make them practice that over and over again as if it was the final shot at the buzzer. And that's the training. And so if they can do it, yeah, we can do it too. Maybe not win a championship, but in other areas of life, we can train ourselves not to react to the pressures of it's going to be a busy day. So with me, I found that my Mondays are particularly busy with clinical schedule and meetings. It's so easy for my mind to say at 6:30 or 7 o'clock, you know, I don't need to sit today. What I've learned in the last few years is that is the day when I need to sit. That's the day when I can train my mind to do patient persistence. It's like folks who say, you know, when you go on a retreat, it's so nice to send metta to everyone when you're on a retreat. Until you get back on the freeway and the very first person who cuts you across, and then all the metta goes away. So, in fact, practicing under difficult conditions actually yields more results. Then a very practical aspect of this is don't get hung up on what object you choose as your object of concentration. It doesn't matter. In this practice, all you need to do is pick something that is related to the present moment. And depending, as I mentioned during the guided meditation, if your mind is in a restless state, give it something substantial, something solid like the body. So when I give talks here, there is a certain level of nervousness that comes just from having to sit and give a talk. So for me, it's this weight of the body, but then also this beating of the heart. So I can feel my palpitation throughout. So it's become a very comforting thing. It's a very easy thing for me to come to. Whereas on a quiet Saturday, I may come down to the breathing sensation. because I really want to get distilled, my awareness distilled down to something very subtle as just the gentle rising and falling of the breath. But I've never been able to focus my awareness on the tip of my nose. And when I read a couple of books, it said, you must do it this way. No. You can pick anything that serves you at that moment. Many of you know that walking meditation is a very effective technique. And essentially, it's a concentration practice. You just bring your awareness to the physical sensation of walking. And again, don't get hung up on, you know, rising, falling, placing. You can, you know, in winter, when you have a, you know, you can just feel the sensation of the your sweatpants or whatever you're wearing kind of just rubbing against your thigh. Whatever is comforting for you, whatever allows you to bring your awareness, do that. There's nothing magical about the breath or the sensation of the sole of your feet touching the floor, at least for this kind of simple concentration practice. And I mentioned about vision as well. So when you're feeling sleepy or particularly restless, using an image, or as you know, many people use the flame, or something, a beautiful, you know, a tree in bloom, or a picture of a flower, anything that makes it easy for you to keep coming back to. What I do almost every morning is I have a ticking clock in my study, and I just do 15 minutes of just staying with the ticking. And it's just worked for me for years, and it's amazing. Now it's become such a habit, so when I happen to be traveling and I don't have a ticking clock, I find it hard to practice. So you can see how concentration practice without the awareness can become a habit. But it's a better habit than, you know, doing other things. So even though I realize that it's become a habit, but it's a better habit than something else I could do. And then I want to reiterate that don't get carried away by descriptions of one-pointedness and focusing, because then if you take it concretely, then you really strive after a very narrow focus. As I mentioned earlier, you can create a very large focus. And sometimes if you're sitting in a room like this, you can use the space of a room like this as your object of awareness as well. Because as some teachers have pointed out, we've become so goal-directed that we are good at connecting with objects, but not the space in between. And so the spaciousness, there is an opening of the heart that becomes easier when we connect to the space as opposed to the ceiling or the lights, the kind of gap in between. And I found that I could do it much more easily when I'm doing lying meditation. So I'm lying on the floor, and suddenly space takes on a completely different perspective, because 90% of the time that my eyes are open, I'm in this vertical position. So try whatever works for you. Have a kind of repertoire. Just be careful not to keep jumping around. That's just another restlessness of the mind. So for it to become a habit, you know, maybe for the first few weeks, see which object is easy for your mind naturally to connect to. So if you have asthma, I wouldn't ask you to focus on your breath. You know, or if you're prone to anxiety and tightness, either in your abdomen or in your chest, you may want to stay away from these areas. And so do some trial and error, but you will find that one particular object becomes easy for you to connect to, and then just try that for several months as a kind of a skill that you're cultivating. And always watch for signs of effortfulness. That anytime you feel like I'm trying hard, just pull back, even to the point of opening your eyes and connecting to something here. Because at its core, this is a very effortless practice. Some of you may have heard of this contemporary teacher called Saida Utejaniya. Mark quotes him quite a lot, and many of us have found his teachings very helpful. So he talks about, does this exercise when he's giving talks. How many of you have heard Saida Utejaniya's talks? Oh, you haven't. Okay, then let's do this. So put your hands together. And when are you aware that your hands are connected, the two hands? So when did you become aware that your hands, your palms are touching? Sorry? When I mentioned it. That's awareness. So it's that's all it takes, is that, my hands are touching. So if you heard Mark Nunberg's guided meditations recently, he'll say touching is happening. Because what Sayadaw Tejaniya points out is that he's somewhat anti-pure samadhi practice. And it's not that he's opposed to it, but what he points out that is if you get stuck into just pure concentration practice, there's not much awareness. There's not wisdom coming on. You're getting calmness, but you're not aware of what's happening in your mind and body. So his point is that you become aware that I am, my palms are touching. But as soon as your mind wanders somewhere else, you don't have to worry. You say, I'm aware of thinking. And then you come back to hands are touching. But if you just think about it for a second, for you to be aware of this touching requires minimal effort. But we make it so that I must focus here. And there is no must. The mind will do whatever it does. So if your mind is in a place where it wants to go somewhere else, forcing it to come back in a forceful way is what feels effortful. But if you take it for granted that, oh, I'm now aware that my mind has gone there, drop there and come back, there's much less effort. It sounds easy, I'll acknowledge, but the more you practice, you have a sense of how much your awareness drifts, but you can also stay with that sense of awareness. And so his teaching is, his idea of concentration is continuity of awareness. I'll have to acknowledge that in my day-to-day life, it's very difficult. I found it easier during retreat practice. But the way I've translated in my daily life, including as I was driving from St. Paul, is anytime I become aware that my mind is wandering, I come back to the sense of my buttock sitting on the seat cushion. So, as often as I could. So, there's a part of my mind that's driving on autopilot. I set my cruise control to 55, 56. So everyone else is breezing around me. So I don't have to do any work of driving. It's a Sunday afternoon. I can sit in the middle lane. Everyone can breeze around me. So I can literally do a kind of a gentle form of concentration practice for 15 minutes. So and my story was what I'll be saying here today. So the anxiety of having to give this talk causes my mind to keep giving this talk several times. So giving the talk, but no one's listening. Come back to the seat. Giving the talk, come back to the seat. So, again, as I mentioned, I don't sit here as a teacher, so I'm not preaching. I'm just sharing with you what I practice. But this aspect, I found that I don't pay as much attention to those nice people who breeze past me at 70 miles an hour. They must be in a hurry. But it's just, they don't bother me because I've given my mind something more wholesome to do. Okay, some cautions about samadhi practice. And I've also mentioned some of these, but it bears calling them out again. So remember, this is just a narrowing of your focus. So if at some level you want to understand the workings of your mind, the vipassana, the insight, then you recognize that this is just a skill that you develop to still your mind to some level so that you can then watch its reactive patterns. So for example, if you get good at this, then you're sitting, you do a 45-minute meditation sit, and then you find that after 15 minutes, your mind is sufficiently calm. Then you can easily transition to, let me just pull back and see what this mind does. So it may come up with some argument you've been having with your spouse or your brother. And so that story arises, and then you realize that that story creates this tension. And boom, you're off to the story. Oh, then you'll have to come back. So the stillness allows you to watch the workings of your mind. Without the stillness, all we're doing is living in the drama that the mind creates. So most of us that are committed to vipassana, understanding the mind, use this just as a tool. So on some days, the mind is so all over the place that this just is a way to calm your mind. But on other times, and especially those of you who do retreat practice, the first couple of days you really want to do a kind of samadhi practice to get to a level of stillness and then start watching the workings of your mind. And I mentioned earlier, stillness is an outcome, or at least slowing down is often an outcome of this practice, but not always. So be careful that your mind has ways of conning yourself. You may not think that you're doing this with a certain outcome in mind, but you will see this desire for your mind to be calm, that wanting. and there'll be this tightness that comes with it. So the tightness could be because you're trying too hard, or it is that you're so desperate for your mind to be calm that you end up sabotaging the process. So just recognize, be kind to yourself. Maybe today there may not be much calmness because of the circumstances. So all you can do is maybe sit for 7-8 minutes. At least you're not physically acting out the restlessness of your mind. The level of calmness has no bearing on the state of your mind. So you can be incredibly calm and still be incredibly unwise. Again, going back to Tiger Woods. You know, the calmness has no correlation to wisdom. And the Buddha realized that if you believe his historical narrative, India apparently was crawling with these various meditation practitioners back then. And so he sought out a teacher who was known for deep states of concentration. And so he got to a certain level very quickly. But then he realized, as soon as I open my eyes and get back out on the street, it's all gone. So what's the point of having a deep level of concentration if it means I have to walk around with my eyes closed? So he went to another teacher who took him to an even more deeper level of concentration, and the same result. And so that's also, I recognized when I went on long retreats, is that it was so wonderful. You know, by day 4 or 5, I've got a buzz going to the point of addiction. It's like, I really like it. I want to hold on to it. When can I come back on the next retreat? But then as soon as I get on I-94, it's back to square one. And so at least for my personal practice, retreat helps in understanding the workings of my mind in a more detailed level, but just doing retreats without the daily habit of slowing my mind down is useless. That's more like going to a spa. You know, or it's like, you know, running a marathon every 3 to 4 months. All you end up doing is hurting your body. Retreat probably doesn't hurt your body, but it, you know, in terms of overall insight, changing our habit patterns, you're better off doing this for 10 to 15 minutes every day and doing no retreats if your life doesn't permit it, as opposed to just, you know, spending your vacation time doing retreats but not doing any basic practice on a daily basis. And as I mentioned just now, calmness, especially those of you who do either do retreats often or for whom calmness comes very quickly. As I said, some of you have this wiring where you can sit for 30 minutes and boom, you are there with your object of meditation and you have the sense of peace and you think you're on your way to nirvana. No, you're just on your way to an attachment to this sense of calmness. As I said, it's better than sitting in front of the TV or YouTube, but to the extent you want to have some wisdom, you want to go to the next level. So Suzuki Roshi, who brought Zen to the United States, said that meditation to achieve samadhi is sightseeing practice. You know, it's like vacation. I'm chilled out, I'm enjoying the sights, but there's really not much wisdom going on there. And some of you who believe that samadhi practice and the stillness is the goal of practice can get discouraged if you don't achieve those outcomes, and then you stop doing the other wholesome stuff altogether. But to the extent that you, at least many of you, are committed to vipassana, insight practice, and mindfulness, you really want to have a sense of what is samadhi, what is vipassana, and where do they intersect. So I gave you the example earlier. On some days, if your life circumstances permit, you know, give yourself 40, 45 minutes. And so then you can see that I started off at this level of restlessness. My mind is calmer now, and then perhaps I can pull back and practice open awareness. And so this is not a talk on vipassana, but it's just to be, I wanted to mention that so that you're aware that you can transition, you can do both at the same time. You don't want to be bouncing back and forth, but in a mindful way, you can transition from samadhi to this. But if you find that as soon as you do that, your argument with your spouse comes up as a drama and you start churning, then you realize your mind is not ready for that kind of awareness, so you can come back to your body. You can come back to samadhi practice. So you can do it in a fluid way so long as you're aware of what you're doing at what moment. The other thing, How many of you are aware of the five hindrances? Okay, so let me mention that. So, again, if you do meditation practice for any length of time, there are these five hindrances that are described in the text that come up very often. So one is craving. And the craving can even be too far what you're doing right now. So if you achieve a level of stillness, or if it gets you out of doing the, you know, putting out the laundry and taking out the trash, you know, something that your spouse wants you to do, you may find it so comforting just to hide away in your meditation, you know, area. So, but there can be this, this craving that arises that often can take your mind away from what you're doing. Or you can have aversion from, so the mind goes off into some stories about things that are happening in your life. There can be restlessness that comes up, or there can be doubt that comes up. Why am I doing this? Am I doing it correctly? Am I watching correctly? So some of these may be appropriate signs of maybe you're not doing it correctly, but most often doubt is a very pernicious way of your mind saying, you really don't want to do this. Why don't you go sit in front of the internet? And so I haven't done a lot of Pali canon reading, but there are a few lists that I have studied in detail, and one list I would encourage folks to read is about the five hindrances, because they're a core part of daily practice that come in the way of us not sticking with it. And one setting in which the hindrances are somewhat easy to watch is samadhi practice, because it's such a simple instruction. And so all you're asking your mind to do is for 10 to 15 minutes, just come back to the butt, come back to the breath, or whatever. What's so awful about it? And so when your mind says, do anything but, then that's one way to watch the hindrances. So there you can blend both the samadhi and some awareness of what's happening. So this, I found, is a, you know, good way to begin to connect with what your favorite hindrances are. And, you know, different people have different poisons, and for some, there is a pattern to it. And then finally, as I mentioned, this is my personal experience. The benefit of this practice on patience has been just tremendous. And so if you find that there are aspects of your life where you're particularly impatient, then you may want to bring that up as an image. So, for example, you say, I'm going to do a 20-minute samadhi practice. And on this particular day, things are going well, and you find some stillness. Just bring that situation that causes you impatience. Just bring that up, feel the energy surge, and then come back to the body, and come back to your object of meditation. So you're not being patient with that thing that is so difficult for you to be patient with, but you're connecting the activity of letting go, being with the way things are, but with the connection to the thing that brings you impatience. So 4 or 5 years ago, if I just sat on I-94 and said, be patient with that driver, I would never have got anywhere. But if I said, that thing is happening, but I'm going to come back to this very nicely designed seat, and this, you know, this lumbar support, very ergonomic, you know, I can be grateful for this air-conditioned car, this silent room. So I'm not dropping him, I'm not even letting go of the truck, I'm just giving my mind something else. But along the way, what I found is I'm becoming patient with those drivers. So if you have activities where you repeatedly find yourself becoming impatient, you can do that. Or it's also, you can bring up some of these images, feel the impatience, and then do the samadhi practice. So you, at least this is my experience, you find a way of letting go without having to let go. I think I'll stop here. There are about 5-6 minutes left if there are any questions.
Yeah. Haven't done any long retreats since 2001, and it always seems very foreign to me when people talk about insight. The concentration part seems sort of natural for me when I do it. When you talked about the driving example, I can relate to that and relate to other things in life that need to be looked at and addressed. But not during times of meditation. I don't connect the two. To me, if I stop concentrating and try to be open, I don't notice things arriving to be contemplated on, let's say.
And you summarized exactly where I found myself a few years ago. I became an intellectual practitioner. Tons of books, tons of Dharma Seed talks, and I was doing all the motions of going through it without, I was practicing on and off, but there wasn't that energy. So this is what I mentioned earlier in my last talk about keeping it simple. I have to do it every day, every year, at least once a year, to keeping it simple, because my mind's tendency is to complicate things, but our lives are complicated. And so it's often very difficult to see the connection between why am I doing this and then this esoteric insight or enlightenment that people talk about. So I stopped chasing after that. And so if it happens, it'll happen, but I can never make it happen. And if I'm trying to emulate what somebody else's experience, I'm just chasing after the rainbow kind of thing. And so as all the wise teachers have said, you don't have to chase after anything. You just have to connect with the way things are right now. And so insight is about what's happening right now. But I can give you some examples of how it's helped me. One was the driving thing. And it may sound trivial, but I was aware of how much suffering there was in my body when I was stuck in traffic. There's nothing I can do to get traffic moving, but my mind had created this narrative that if I just get tightened up enough and fret enough, there'll be the passage, like a Moses, you know, the Red Sea passage opens up. So I have a leadership role in my department. So I often have to have, you know, difficult conversations with physician colleagues or administrators. And the first couple of years was all the drama. And the drama was not just at the meeting, but a day or so before, because I was practicing what I was going to say out of the nervousness. And then I realized that all the things that I practiced never came out to be true. And so then I realized I was suffering a day before. I was not as present. And at the end of the meeting, I just felt drained. And so it occurred to me that this 10-minute conversation with this person, who's a benign person, he's not going to torture me, really caused so much suffering for me for 24, 30, you know, 72 hours. And so the day before, I would say anytime I recognized that I was dialoguing about the future, come back to what's happening now. And so I don't have to sit and meditate. I could just come back to what I can do right now, moment by moment by moment. So what now, after this is my fifth year of medical directorship, even if I have a difficult meeting, I can pick up the tightening very quickly, because the tightening always comes up from anxiety, sense of stress. So I feel it, mind starts to jump, come back. And I can do it. I may miss out on a good TV program. I may miss out on, you know, anything that's happening. I could be walking along the river and for half an hour having this dialogue with my colleague the next day. And so now, before I even get into the meeting, I get to the room before as often as I can, and then I get familiar with that chair. I get familiar with the tension. Some of the tension I can't do anything because that's how I'm conditioned, but I can drop my shoulders. I can connect with this sensation. And anytime I feel this tension rising as I'm responding to my colleague, I can feel the energy. I don't need this energy to respond to my colleague. The voice doesn't need to go up, and I don't need to lean forward. So I can. So it took me a couple of years. So that's how I connect meditation practice to daily life. I haven't succeeded with my wife, but that may be a longer thing. But I pick my battles, you know, small. And a lot of this I learned from my chronic pain work. So some of you know I do a workshop on chronic pain. So a lot of this body stuff came from my experience with chronic pain. We have time for one more question. Well, I'll go home disappointed that there was just one question. But that's... So the question was, how do you bridge concentration to wisdom? Perhaps I'll give another talk on wisdom, but at least my take on wisdom is it's not something that's already preordained. It's something that arises spontaneously. And so for me, again, coming back to my obsession with driving, the wisdom was how much of my mental peace and my body ease I had surrendered to someone who I don't even know. That's the only wisdom for me. It's not some halo behind my head. It's just that day after day, month after month, every time I drove on 94, anytime somebody breezed past me in a way that I thought was inappropriate, I surrendered my peace of mind to that person, and I would just get tightened up. So that was the wisdom for me. Same way with the wisdom of, if I have an important meeting tomorrow, why should it ruin my Sunday evening, a beautiful summer evening, when I could be walking, enjoying the birds, connecting with the green leaves, instead of dialoguing with my colleague for tomorrow. To me, that's the wisdom. Well, thank you for listening. And
this talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.